listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Ukraine's parliament declared martial law on Monday following a naval skirmish Sunday with Russia in the waters near Crimea. According to Russia's Federal Security Service, or FSB, Ukraine's Berdyansk and Nikopol gunboats crossed the Russian maritime border with a tugboat and sailed towards the Kerch Strait, which separates Crimea from the Russian mainland, where the ships were seized by Russia after, according to Moscow, failing to reply to a lawful demand to stop. The Kerch Strait hosts the recently completed 11-mile Crimean bridge connecting the Russian mainland to Crimea. The incident at sea was the subject of two emergency sessions of the UN Security Council Monday. When the Council finally did meet after wrangling over an agenda, Russia's Deputy Permanent Representative Dmitry Polyanki said the episode was a deliberate provocation by Kiev intending to boost the sagging poll numbers of Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko, who trails in third place for elections set for next March behind former President Yulia Tymoshenko, and Vladimir Zelensky, an actor and comedian. RT's Caleb Maupin has more.
So there were two emergency meetings of the UN Security Council, not one. The meetings were called regarding the situation in the Kerch Strait. Now, at this point, the first meeting was called by Russia, and Western countries did not approve of the agenda item, so it was not adopted. The agenda was not adopted. There was then a second meeting called on behalf of Ukraine. Now, the representative of Russia spoke at the first session. When he spoke, he accused Western partners of behaving like overgrown toddlers, essentially, by quibbling over resolutions and not simply working to resolve the crisis. Furthermore, he pointed out that the provocative actions of the Ukraine are coming as a Ukrainian presidential election approaches. And he pointed out that Poroshenko needs to boost his ratings.
President Poroshenko's ratings are extremely low, but the elections are not so far away. So how do you hold on to power? His team really needs a serious exacerbation of the situation and ideally a war. The necessary next portion of the anti-Russian drug so that people in the country believe that all their troubles are due to Russia.
The second session was called on behalf of Ukraine. We heard from the United Kingdom, France, Poland, and they rolled out a narrative that we have heard many times before about Russia being supposedly an aggressor, threatening the world and wanting to annex more territory.
What we witnessed this weekend is yet another reckless Russian escalation.
It follows on from Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea in 2014.
The Ukrainian side violated our border in a place which, even before 2014, was Russian territory.
Russia must respect the full implementation of the Minsk Agreement.
I hope that you read the Minsk Agreement and know perfectly that there's not a single word about Crimea.
Russia wants to annex the Sea of Azov.
And now it surprisingly turns out that we occupy the Azov Sea as well. This is something new.
I'd like to assure Ukraine of our solidarity.
The United States will continue to stand with the people of Ukraine against the Russian aggression.
So this could be perceived as carte blanche for Ukraine to carry out further provocations.
Before the UN Security Council meeting began, the Russian Foreign Ministry was asked to comment on what it expected at the proceedings. They said that they had no illusions. They expected that, as has happened many times before, regardless of what facts they presented before the Security Council, these facts would fall on deaf ears, and the same narrative would be rolled out by Western leaders. And it appears that the prediction given by the Russian Foreign Ministry has proved to be correct.
That was RT's Caleb Maupin reporting from New York. As if to drive home his point, Vladimir Yushchenko, who's the permanent representative of Ukraine to the UN, held a press conference at the UN headquarters in New York.
Any questions, please?
Ambassador, you just heard the Russian ambassador saying there was a provocation. Why do they think it was a provocation?
I don't know. As I said earlier, I see no logic in the Russian behavior, but that's not accidental that I started my statement that we heard about the sort of historical trip into 1939. I think what is happening nowadays is exactly the repetition of the good old Russian or Soviet tradition to create a problem and then to blame everybody around for that problem. That's exactly the same. They make a provocation in the Azov Sea. Unfortunately, it led to, not to casualties, of course, but to damage, to some very dangerous consequences. And now they are blaming Ukraine in provoking this provocation.
Can you tell us more about the sailor who you know? It's Pamela Falk from CBS News, who you mentioned during your talk who was injured. Could you give us any more specifics?
No, we don't have any information because, our Minister of Defense and the Commander of the Navy was trying to get in touch with any Russian authorities on that issue. Also, the Ukrainian ombudswoman was trying to get in touch with those sailors, but with no result. We only know that they were, probably delivered to some place in the Krasnodar region, which is the Black Sea shore of the Russian Federation, for medical treatment, but we don't know any other details on that.
You had no contact with them?
No contact, absolutely.
Joseph Klein. Joseph Klein, Canada Free Press. The Russian deputy ambassador indicated that Russia at least has the right and may actually go forward with prosecuting the detained sailors. I'd like to know your response to that. Would Ukraine consider bringing this issue to the International Court of Justice or some other international forum?
Yes, of course we will do. Everything which happened yesterday was carefully recorded and it will be added to our cases in the International Court of Justice and in other organs, including here in the United Nations, of course. We think that our sailors committed no crime whatsoever. So this is the claim that Crimea is Russian, but it is not recognized by anyone except Russia. It's not recognized by the UN General Assembly. It is not recognized by the UN Security Council. So what are they claiming? Saying that Ukrainian sailors committed a crime by crossing the Russian border. Where is this border? It does not exist.
Ambassador, what do you expect your next step to be? I mean, ideally, what would you like to see happening right away?
Ideally, we would like to see the tightening of the sanctions. Because, as I was saying many times before, the sanctions is the only real tool which can make Russia at least to start thinking of their behavior. Because the sanctions, they do bite. Whatever the Russian government is saying, and they went as far as saying that due to the sanctions, the Russian economy is now in a better state, but we know the figures that at least 6% of the Russian GDP is already cut or down as a direct result of the sanctions. We would like to see more personal sanctions. We would like to see freezing of the accounts of those Russians who were involved in this incident yesterday. And as we speak, I know that in Brussels and in Vienna, EU in Brussels, OSCE in Vienna, and in other places. By the way, today there's a meeting of political directors of the Normandy format in Berlin. We expect that all those gatherings will approve very strong statements. First, condemning Russia for what they did yesterday, and secondly, calling for the further sanctions against Russia, economic sanctions.
Mr. Ambassador, so far, how you consider the reaction that, for example, the European countries in the Security Council had, and any other country? Did you expect more? Are you satisfied with the way they reacted to this incident?
Yes, we are satisfied because there is a certain evolution in the positions of not only Security Council members, but of a wider UN membership. I will give you just one example. You probably remember that there are solid or stable 26 countries which voted against the Ukrainian-Crimean resolution for two consecutive years. But when we proposed the additional agenda item, the situation in the occupied territories of Ukraine, there were 13 countries voting against. So there is a growing knowledge in the world, in the UN General Assembly membership, that the justice is with Ukraine. So we expect the growing number of countries which will be supporting our initiatives, our resolutions on the Crimea, on the militarization of Crimea, and Azov Sea, by the way. The vote in General Assembly will be held on the 17th of December on that resolution, and I'm pretty sure that we will now beef up that resolution. We will add certain language into that with reference to yesterday's events and today's discussion in the Security Council.
Ambassador, you've called for stronger sanctions against Russia, but as has been made clear by the Swedish delegation and by the UN Rapporteur on Human Rights in the DPRK, the sanctions devastate the normal people, the children, the vulnerable, the elderly, the ill. So why are you calling for sanctions on Russia that will only harm people and will not really make much difference? I mean, it's really devastating to the people in North Korea, and it's...
Well, let us not compare North Korean people with the Russian people, first of all. Secondly, I think that you should refer your question to the Russian people. Let them ask the same question from their President Putin. And thirdly, I deliberately said something about freezing of accounts. We're not aiming at Russian people. We're aiming at the Russian leadership, at those who are giving orders, to ram the Ukrainian ships, to invade into Crimea, to invade into Donbass. We are aiming at the Russian government and not at the Russian people. I don't think that you should worry about sufferings of the Russian people.
That's what they always say. about sanctions, and sanctions always hurt the vulnerable and the innocent and the children and women and the ill.
As I said, let them ask their own president about this. Why is it happening?
And can you talk about just conversations you've had with Ambassador Haley? Can you talk, is she on board with more sanctions? What other consequences do you think Russia
could
face?
I'm very thankful to Ambassador Haley. It's very unfortunate that she's about to leave, because I think that she is a real leader in the Security Council, not only of the United States delegation, but of the wider coalition, if I may call it, or the so-called group of friends of Ukraine in the Security Council. She is very much outspoken. She is very much straightforward. And I had the opportunity to thank her many, many times. I believe that her voice is a kind of decisive voice in the Security Council when we stand up against the Russian aggression.
Ambassador, speaking of U.S. policy, would you like to hear something from the President of the United States? His silence is somewhat deafening to some of us.
Of course, I would love to see his tweet about yesterday's incident, and I'm looking forward for that. Probably after today's meeting, he will say something or write something in his Twitter.
Thank you.
Russia's deputy permanent representative to the UN, Dmitry Polyanki, also held a press conference in New York Monday, following the one we just heard with Ukraine's permanent representative. And we apologize for the audio quality of this clip, but we wanted you to hear what was actually said firsthand.
I'm here for those who want to learn more than I just said during these two meetings that we had of the Security Council. I don't know what... Maybe some particular questions you have. Is it working? Maybe. Oh, maybe I should knee down. I don't know, because this is really... Is it detachable? Oh. Okay, I'm too high for this microphone, I think. So, in case you have some questions, in addition to what I just said during the two Security Council meetings that we had, I am open to answer them. So please, I don't know what may be the field of your particular interest. Yeah.
Ambassador, I have a question.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Joseph Klein, Canada Free Press. Do you have any response to the Ukrainian ambassador's presentation?
Can you come over here, because I can't really hear you. Somehow it's very noisy.
Okay. Do you have any response to the Ukrainian ambassador's presentation of evidence regarding audios of shoot-to-kill commands, and also his claim that the Ukrainian ships were actually exiting the area when they were fired upon?
Yeah, I got your question. You know, we are serious people and we conduct a serious investigation. Do you hear me?
Yeah, no, it's very hard.
I don't know. And now? Okay. So we are serious people and we conduct serious investigation. We do not rush through the conclusions. We know that there are some video material that is circulated, but we usually take account of them, but not as primary source of accusation of somebody or not somebody. As I told during the meeting, we will conduct investigation and we will present the outcome of this investigation in due course. We think that this is the right approach than to rush to the conclusions after some video footage. We are not belling cats, we are working seriously. Yeah.
Pamela Falkrum, CBS News. Do you expect to release these soldiers? You got a personal plea from the ambassador of Ukraine about the injured soldiers. Do you expect to release any of the soldiers?
Okay, I speak. Okay, you hear me? I'm just worried that you don't hear me. Well, of course, after the investigation that we conduct, there are procedures that are foreseen in the laws of Russian Federation, and we will obey to them. It depends on the investigation. It depends on the charges that they have. We are the country of rule of law, and that's why we will define it according to our laws, which is natural, as any other country. Okay? Yeah.
Do you just heard that?
I think I will act like this.
European countries.
No, I didn't hear because it was too loud. What did they say?
Well, they're condemning and supporting the Ukraine in this. If you didn't hear, then my question, I don't know if you can answer. But the point is, did you expect something different from the European Union? Or did you expect that all the country they show up, some country will not be there?
We know, maybe we're very naive people, but we all the time expect some miracle to happen. Because we really are pointing out to the real problem. And we are hearing some myths and some legends and some claims about Russian aggression, occupation, whatever. Today I learned about the fact that we occupied Azov Sea and we are going to occupy Mariupol. That was really a very big surprise for me from a Ukrainian ambassador. So we hope that our Western colleagues will understand that the problem is there in Kyiv. And it's the problem with this Maidan regime, with his actions. And what happened recently? What happened recently during these days was a clear-cut provocation. And we actually wanted to convene Security Council meeting to condemn this provocation and to discuss the ways to avoid these provocations happening, because this is very dangerous. It can lead to some unpredictable situation, and we just want to avoid it. But unfortunately, our European, well, I don't think we should mention European partners, because European partners are following what the Americans are saying in this regard. So the Western countries, unfortunately, they predictably disappointed us, repeating the same mantra about Russian aggression, occupation, about human rights and violation in Crimea, and so on and so forth. So from this point of view, this was very disappointing. Okay.
The sailors, what's going to happen? What's next?
The sailors are being treated. There are three of them having injuries, not serious injuries. And their life is absolutely out of danger. And as I said during the meeting of Security Council, that the full responsibility for this incident lies on those who gave them this criminal order to act like they were acting, provoking Russian bodyguards.
But when do you plan to release sailors and everybody, hostages, Ukrainian hostages taken in Russia? When exactly are you planning to release them?
There are two questions, but I actually don't know about any Ukrainian hostages, as you put it. If maybe you have some other information than me.
Ukrainian army, Navy army taken by you. When exactly are you planning to release them?
Ah, you mean those who conducted some crimes? After the investigation, of course. The three sailors, they were acting in provocation, and they were conducting a crime according to the laws of the Russian Federation. So each and every sovereign country has the right to prosecute people who conduct crimes and unlawful acts on its territory. That's our approach. Okay? No more questions? Thank you very much.
That was Russia's Deputy Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Dmitry Polyansky, at a press conference Monday. Ambassador Polyansky also spoke with RT Monday, and we bring you some excerpts from that conversation.
I fear that after the Western countries that have particular influence on Ukraine really displayed such an attitude, the Ukrainian side might feel a little bit emboldened to engage in further provocations of this type. We tried to ask everybody why exactly the Ukrainian ships that previously interacted with our border guards and which passed the Kerch Strait without any problems, the ships who know all the rules, all the procedures, suddenly decided to avoid them and to engage in this provocation. So that's why we tried to ask this question to our fellow members and to get an answer from them. And I discovered that they were not very eager to discuss this concrete situation. They immediately changed to the alleged annexation of Crimea by my country, which we, of course, fiercely denied. And I specifically mentioned that Crimea was not a topic on Security Council agenda. It's very worrying for us as a country, because it's a neighboring country. If a neighboring country declares a martial law, it's quite clear that there can be some repercussions for us. We also need to be on alert. And this doesn't contribute to dissuade the tensions between us, which were not created on our initiative.
One of those neighboring countries is Kazakhstan, which, like both Russian Federation and Ukraine, is a former republic of the former Soviet Union. Kazakhstan's permanent representative made these comments at the UN Security Council meeting on Monday.
Kazakhstan, as a member of the Council, is open to dialogue and is ready to debate over international security issues in transparent discussions for the cause of preventing international conflicts. Taking this into account, as well as the need to consider the matter within the framework of the Security Council, our delegation was ready to vote in favor of both requests, of Ukraine and of Russia. Kazakhstan considers both people of Ukraine and Russia as the brotherly nations to our country, sharing common history throughout the past. In this regard, we urge both parties to restrain from steps leading to any further escalation of bilateral relations. It is of special importance for our state that Ukraine remains sovereign, stable, and independent. Kazakhstan is ready to assist to both nations, Russian Federation and Ukraine, to overcome crisis in their relations. Kazakhstan adheres to a balanced approach of solving the Ukrainian crisis through peaceful negotiations and a mediation process based on key principles and norms of international law and the United Nations Charter. My country has taken and continues to take part in multilateral consultations in seeking a settlement of this issue. We are determined to work closely with all members of the Council without political expediency and in an open, objective, responsible, and constructive way. It should be noted that in the past, our country made its contribution to the launch of the Normandy format and eventual conclusion of the Minsk agreements. Kazakhstan has as well repeatedly expressed its readiness to render its all-round assistance in the process, supporting a peaceful settlement in the southeast of Ukraine and fostering robust relations between Ukraine and Russia. In this way, our delegation is concerned that the negotiation process to resolve the Ukrainian conflict has actually been suspended during the past months. This is evidenced by the lack of contacts in the Normandy format at a higher level. Such suspension has a full potential for sparks of new negative developments in the region. To this end, it is with regret that we recognize the incident between the Russian Federation and Ukrainian Navy vessels in the Kerch Strait that took place yesterday on 25th of November. Kazakhstan urged both sides to act with utmost restraint to de-escalate the situation between two states. We consider this as the only viable existing mechanism in a peaceful way by restraining from any kind of negative actions. Such an incident can drastically raise the chances for an unintended spark to set the region on fire. Both governments must urgently step in and try to negotiate a deal to de-escalate the situation with possible assistance from the international community. We believe that sustainable peace and full-fledged normalization of relations between both countries can also be achieved through establishing CBMs in the security and economic dimensions as well. We should not allow further escalation of tensions, which could lead to active warfare in this new area. I thank you, Mr. President.
China, which has declared itself a strategic partner of the Russian Federation, is chairing the UN Security Council for the month of November. This was China's deputy permanent representative to the UN, Wu Aido, chairing Monday's meeting, speaking on behalf of the People's Republic of China.
China has noted the altercation between Russian and Ukrainian naval ships in the waters near the Kerch Strait. We are concerned with the tension arising thereof. China hopes and calls for the relevant parties to exercise restraint to avoid any further escalation of tension and properly resolve the relevant issues through dialogue and consultations. China has all along maintained its objectivity and impartiality on the Ukrainian crisis. China respects the sovereignty and territorial integrity of all countries, including Ukraine, and opposes any external forces interfering in Ukraine's internal affairs. We are always of the view that military solution will get nowhere. Dialogues and negotiations are the only way to resolve crisis. The international community must stay the course of diplomatic efforts to push for a political settlement of the Ukrainian crisis. The discussion of the Security Council should be conducive to genuine ease of tension in the affected areas of Ukraine to play a constructive role in facilitating a political solution. China is of the view that all the relevant parties should earnestly implement the new Minsk Agreement, stay the course of political settlement through dialogue and consultation to seek a comprehensive solution to the Ukrainian issue, so that Ukraine can achieve peace, stability, and development, whereby all ethnic communities can live in peace and Ukraine can live in peace with all the countries in the region. China stands ready to continue its positive role in the political settlement of the crisis.
The Russian Federation had called the first of the two UN Security Council meetings on Monday about the incident near Crimea. Russia had proposed a provisional agenda item entitled Violation of the Borders of the Russian Federation. That first agenda item was rejected by a procedural vote of 7, including France, Kuwait, the Netherlands, Poland, Sweden, the UK, and the US, to 4, Bolivia, China, Kazakhstan, and Russia, with 4 abstentions. Here are some excerpts from the permanent representative of Bolivia at the final session on Monday.
Thank you, President. We're grateful to Ms. Di Carlo, USG for Political Affairs, for her briefing. We call upon the parties to work to find a peaceful solution through dialogue, bearing in mind the range of measures for the implementation of the Minsk agreements, so as to achieve a balance of interests without overlooking the principles of preventive diplomacy and good offices geared towards a negotiated political solution. We call on the leaders of both parties to overcome the divisions of the past, to prioritize peace for the benefit of their peoples, and we urge the international community to focus on the concerns of all parties with a neutral and equitable approach to achieve lasting stability. Thank you very much.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello, welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. The rivalry between the U.S. and Iran is threatening to tear Iraq apart. Can the war-torn country manage the pressure from both sides? To talk about this, I'm joined by Dr. Ali Alawi, Iraq's former Minister of Trade, Defense and Finance.
Emerging from a life-or-death struggle against ISIS, Iraq is managing to hold itself together, while hoping that the new faces in the capital will steer it forward safe and sound. But with Iran and the United States using Iraq as a competitive arena, can Baghdad stay out of the Tehran-Washington Cold War forever? Does the new government risk being torn apart by the foreign players' rivalry? Or is there profit to be made from trying to play both sides?
Dr. Ali Alawi, Iraq's former Minister of Trade, Defense and Finance, welcome to the show. It's really great to have you with us today. Dr. Alawi, the spokesman for the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq has said that American forces will remain in the country as long as they're needed there. Earlier, the Pentagon said that U.S. troops would withdraw when Daesh is defeated. Do you think that will happen?
Yes, I think so. I mean, there really is no need for them militarily unless there is a resurgence of the ISIS or Daesh activity. There seems to be some incidents taking place along the Iraq-Syrian frontier, which seems to indicate that there is the possibility of Daesh regrouping in that area. So unless and until that threat is removed, I think the United States will find a reason to prolong its presence in Iraq.
And also, there are the small pockets of ISIS in Kirkuk, in Anbar provinces, and given Iraqi army's considerable success in fighting Daesh, can they eliminate the remaining jihadists without America's help?
I think so, yes. I mean, as you said rightly, that Daesh is now fragmented. They're trying to regroup, but I doubt if they'll get to the same scale and scope of activities that they had before. So there will be pockets of insurgency activity, some perhaps intense, and I think all of that is within the capabilities of the Iraqi security forces. The United States really provides primarily air support and sometimes intelligence on the ground. But that was in the early years of the war against Daesh. Now I think both of these capabilities are well in hand by the Iraqi security forces.
But why do you think it's taken so long to finally eliminate them from Iraq? I mean, it's been a long time since Daesh has been reduced to this couple of small pockets in the countryside.
Well, I mean, the Daesh insurgency, or the whatever you want to call it, didn't really come out of a vacuum. There's a certain organic connection between it and the insurgency that erupted after the American invasion and occupation of 2003. It went dormant during the period, say, between 2010 and 2014. But it was fed by the civil war in Syria, and then it erupted in a much more dangerous and formidable way in Iraq. The point I'm trying to make here is that unless the underlying circumstances that allowed for the emergence of this very virulent form of violence, I think that we may get sons and even grandsons of Daesh at some point in the future. It's primarily a political issue in Iraq that has taken on military ramifications. And in the final analysis, once you contain the terrorist aspect of it and the insurgency aspect of it, you have to tackle the problem politically.
So are you saying they're going to stay there for another 15 years?
No, I'm not saying they're going to be there, but there will be a form of violent resistance to the changes that have taken place in Iraq since 2003. It will wax and wane, and until you get a stable political order established to which the bulk of the population subscribes to, I think the underlying circumstances might not be necessarily conducive to long-term peace. So you have to undertake really serious reconstruction, serious economic development, serious integration of the destroyed areas into the national, weave them back into the national fabric. Once this is done, I think, and this is a multi-year program, it's unlikely to eliminate the founts or the wellsprings of this violent resistance.
So another big thing is United States withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal and United States imposing sanctions against everyone wanting to continue trading with Iran. Now, the new Prime Minister, Abdul Mahdi, said Iraq will be ruled by its own interests before falling in line with U.S. policies against Tehran. Can Baghdad really confront Washington on this while it still depends on it militarily?
I don't think it can, up to a point, obviously. But if it breaks flagrantly the American unilateral sanctions on Iran, it has to be prepared to pay the consequences. And the consequences is that the United States controls most of the international agencies on which Iraq is one way or another dependent, especially the financial agencies in Washington. And in as much as they can influence the disposition of the resources, the financial resources available to Iraq and access to international markets. And obviously they can affect the extent to which the Iraqi government can declare and act on an independent course of action vis-a-vis Iran. At the same time, I think the Iraqi government does have a very cogent argument that its interests with Iran are so intertwined at the economic and commercial level that it would be in everyone's interest, including that of the United States, not to see this disrupted to the detriment of the Iraqi economy. So they may have an entry point there. But if the Trump administration insists on implementing the sanctions to the finest points possible, they have very powerful sources of leverage on Iraq, especially on the banking and financial side.
Well, because right now we're getting reports that Iraq will stop trucking crude from the Kirkuk oil field to Iran and will export it to Turkey instead to avoid U.S. sanctions. What do you think that means? Does it mean that Baghdad is already dancing to Washington's tune?
Yes, I mean, this is probably a much more easy and much more visible way of acting out the American sanctions in Iraq. There are more difficult and complicated issues, especially the supply of gas from Iran into Iraq, which really fires a lot of the electricity stations. And until we find an alternative source of gas, there's no way that Iraq, which already suffers from serious electricity problems, can unilaterally disband this relationship. There's also a very strong relationship at the level of tourism, and Iraq is religious tourism, and Iraq is a very important market for Iranian goods. Some of these goods can be substituted for, but not all of them. So implementing the American sanctions to the utmost degree is going to have a very profound, deleterious effect on the Iraqi economy. The Iraqi government will try to meet some of the more visible aspects of the sanctions, but otherwise they would have to really think very carefully.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone's doubting the fact that Iran and Iraq are very intertwined on many levels. Iraq's foreign ministry spokesman Ahmed Majoub said that Baghdad may be asking Washington to exclude the country from the anti-Iran sanctions, which may hit Iraq because of its extensive cooperation with Iran. Does Baghdad believe this is possible? I mean, we have John Bolton and Donald Trump running the show in America.
Yes, I mean, again, you have to second-guess what's taking place in Washington and what really drives American policy towards, not only towards Iran, but towards the entire Middle East situation. It is partly Trump's sort of unilateral nationalism, together with a much more ideologically driven position taken by the new neocons, the post-neocons. They may be able to affect the overall direction of policy. And if that policy becomes, in fact, the way the United States is going to engage and interact with Iraq, then it's going to have, I think, very serious repercussions, not only domestically, but on the region as a whole.
You know, also, apart from military assistance, Washington can really help Baghdad put economic reforms in place and fight rampant corruption. What does Tehran have to offer Iraq that could beat what Washington is offering?
Well, we must accept that Iran played a very powerful part in organizing the resistance to Daesh. The United States did not show up on the scene until 1 or 2 months after the fall of Mosul. Iran jumped into the fray very early and played a very important part in mobilizing the resistance and the fight back after the collapse of the Iraqi army. So Iran has, I think, a stabilizing role to play when it comes to these larger issues. And it's not easy for us to find an alternative to the kind of on-the-ground support that we had in the early days of the Daesh crisis, when Daesh was nearly a few miles from the center of Baghdad, and there was really nothing to stop it apart from the popular forces that came into being primarily as a result of the fatwa of Ayatollah Sistani, but organized on the ground by Iranian officers.
Opinion pieces in American press are urging the U.S. government to get involved in supporting the new Iraqi government, saying that it will provide an antidote to the Iranian influence in the country. Whose influence on Iraq is stronger and more influential right now, Iranian or American?
Well, I mean, Iran's influence stretches quite deep, and so especially in the center and south of the country. And I think also these days it has increasingly strong effect on the political classes coming from the north and the west of the country. So, and also in Kurdistan. So, the range of Iranian influence and connections is really quite wide, and in some cases quite deep. They also have a direct effect on the disposition of the popular mobilization forces, the Hashid, where a number of very senior people in the Hashid are one way or another connected with Iran. So the range and extent of Iranian influence is wider and deeper than that of the United States. The United States influence is primarily at the level what I would call the elites, the political elites. There's no sort of America party in it. Inside Iraq, there are no large groups of populations that instinctively support the United States. Perhaps the Kurds, the United States is reasonably popular there. But apart from that, I don't think there's much reservoir of goodwill, popular at the popular level to the United States. There's also that there isn't that much reservoir of goodwill either for, you know, for Iran. But Iranian influence is much wider. It cuts across boundaries, cuts across ethnicities, and cuts across classes. So it is much more woven into the domestic fabric of Iraq's politics in the United States. The United States operates at the level of individuals, elites, and the institutions of the government.
All right, we're going to take a short break right now. When we're back, we'll continue talking to Dr. Ali Alawi, Iraq's former Minister of Trade, Defense and Finance, discussing the situation in a war-torn country. Stay with us.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And we're back with Dr. Ali Alawi, Iraq's former Minister of Trade, Defense and Finance, talking about the tensions in post-ISIS Iraq. Now, you were the staunchest opponent of Saddam Hussein in your life, but you say that the 2003 U.S. invasion was illegal and resulted in dire consequences for Iraq and the whole Middle East. Are you saying that the removing of the dictator wasn't worth it?
No, I mean, this is a loaded question. You have to look back in the circumstances of 2002, 2003 that led to the invasion and occupation. I'm on record as being against using military force to overthrow Saddam. The fact of the matter that it took place and overthrew a dictatorship, that's obviously a positive. But its replacement, which was chaos and anarchy, and then unleashed a whole episode, one of the most violent episodes in modern Middle Eastern history, is something that has to be connected, and those responsible for launching the war have to take responsibility for it. To me, it is not really, the equation doesn't really hold whether it was worthwhile or not. Of course, getting rid of a dictatorship is an important event, but destroying the political framework of the country and upending the entire Middle Eastern order without having any sustainable and stable replacement for it, and unwilling to take the consequences of these drastic actions, is something else entirely. If you want to make it, if you want to make an equation out of it, you would say yes. There are certain freedoms and rights that were denied in the past and that are now available. But in exchange for that, you have a huge personal insecurity, physical destruction, dislocations and displacement of people. And I think the invasion of Iraq also unleashed the forces that ultimately led to the abortive Arab Spring and then the terrible war in Syria. So these consequences were not taken into account at all. And the weight of overthrowing an established sovereign, albeit a terrible dictatorship, a sovereign state, was not taken into account. The consequences of it were not taken into account. And those who are responsible for embarking on this adventure, including, I might say, a large number of Iraqis who participated willingly in it, have to take responsibility for the post-war chaos.
Now, the new Prime Minister, Abdel Abdul Mahdi, has written some time ago that the job of leading Iraq is too complicated, too burdened by special interests, by corruption, and that he won't have enough political strength to succeed. Fast forward a few months and he is the prime minister. Do you think he was right when he was saying that he will fail?
I mean, he analyzed it correctly, but you can also perhaps look at it as a kind of conditional manifesto for him to attain the position of prime minister. He set out the issues and the complexities and the negative aspects of it, with the assumption that if these were removed, then the circumstances would be acceptable for him to assume the post. I can only assume that he feels now that the circumstances that drove him to write this memo of a few months ago have been removed, and that he has a fair shot at reforming the very dysfunctional political system that has misgoverned this country for so long.
But also, Adel Abdul Mahdi is not an immensely popular politician at all. You don't think that he'll be treated as a compromise, like a puppet to be manipulated by real political forces in Iraq, by militias, political parties, etc.?
I can't really speak for that. I mean, he obviously is a very, very adept and competent, competent political figure. He knows the distribution of forces and what finally gave him political power. It's really up to him now to decide whether he's going to make a stand and move towards genuine change and reform, or he will not risk his hold on power by confronting the political factions that have played such a large part in destroying political integrity of the country. It is really his choice, I think.
I want to talk a bit about Syria, because you say that you can't solve the problems of Syria without solving the problems of Iraq. What exact problem in Iraq right now is affecting the situation in Syria?
Well, I think the more Iraq becomes a stable, unified country, focused on development, focused on improving human welfare, focused on removing some of the bottlenecks and obstacles that have thwarted it in the past, the more it can be able to play a part in creating the necessary foundations for a regional economy, which would necessarily include some kind of partnership with countries like Syria, with countries like Iran, with countries like Turkey, creating a new dispensation, a new economic political dispensation in which post-war Syria can fit in. It is impossible, I believe, to resolve the problems of each of these countries individually without looking at them in the regional context. For example, the terrible water crisis that we have in Iraq. I mean, our rivers originate elsewhere. The Euphrates originates in Turkey and passes through Syria. It's impossible to have a local or a purely Iraqi water policy, which is really important. I mean, a large number of the population works in agriculture, without working out the issues with both Turkey and Syria. So there's the issue, for example, of removing trade barriers, of energy exchanges, exchanges of the electricity grid and so on, opening routes, transport routes to the Mediterranean. All these require a very coordinated set of regional policies that bind these countries together in a framework that is different from what was in the past, which was an extremely negative form of competitive one-upmanship, frequently leading to plotting against your neighbor and trying to change the system of government. After the civil war in Syria, and after hopefully we are able to stabilize Iraq on a sustainable basis, the next step must be to work towards some kind of regional confederation of not only at the economic level, but hopefully at the political level, to create the foundations of stability in the area.
So like you're saying, more than two-thirds of Iraq's drinking water comes from outside. So, for instance, whenever Turkey needs to fill its reservoirs with water upstream, Iraq is filling it. Can water be used by Iraq's neighbors to exert political pressure on it? How can Baghdad deal with this vulnerability?
Well, I mean, of course they can, because, as I said earlier, something like 70% of Iraq's population works in agriculture. We're now going through a very, very critical time of water shortages as Turkey fills its dam, and also Iran. Iran, a lot of the tributaries of the Tigris flow from Iran. But Iran really accounts for something like 20% of the water flow into the Iraqi water system. 80% comes by Turkey and Syria. So Turkey is a much more important partner in this aspect. We have to have some kind of regional water treaty or water allocation system that allows for the various demands of these various countries without destroying the agricultural viability of the downriver countries, downstream countries, in this case Iraq. These are, I mean, well-established procedures and systems for creating bilateral and multilateral treaties, riparian treaties, that allow for the distribution of water in an equitable way. This has been ignored because of the crisis in Iraq for the last 40 years. Iraq has not been a party to any of these agreements. So Turkey went ahead and built its huge dam system without really much consideration for what's going to happen downstream. Same thing happened in Syria with the building of the Tabqa Dam and the Assad Lake and so on. Very little consideration was given to the effect on Iraq. We can't allow these problems to be resolved the way that they have been classically resolved, which is through confrontation and conflict and wars and so on. We have to do it in a peaceful, mutually supportive, mutually constructive method, whereby needs and requirements and allocations are done with proper attention to the needs and requirements of each of these countries. Iraq has been really at the tail end of all of these unilateral water policies, and leaving us with an immense problem now. We have to,
well, I mean,
we have to claw back all of that.
I know that street protests already erupted in Basra before over water shortages, and the harrowing examples of drought leading to dire consequences is just next door in Syria. How dangerous can this get?
It can get extremely dangerous. I mean, we're talking about a population in Iraq of nearly 40 million people here. And as I said, a lot of Iraq still is an agricultural society, in spite of the fact that it appears to be a kind of a major, it's also a major oil exporter, but most of the people work in agriculture. If you get large-scale displacement of populations, rural-urban migration, flooding into the cities, and not enough jobs available, and the government not being the employer of last resort, you'll create the social conditions that you had in Syria that played a very large part in creating the sense of dispossession and the sense of oppression that fed into the narrative of the terrorists in Syria. The same thing can happen, easily can happen in Iraq. If people abandon their farms, people can't get water for their crops or for their animals, they will leave. They have no choice. And when they come into the cities, they'll end up in slums, demanding jobs from the government. The government is fiscally stressed. So what will happen? You have hundreds of thousands of people living in shanty towns, prone to all kinds of extreme ideologies and social, extreme social movements.
All right. Thank you very much for this interview. It's been great talking to you. We were talking to Dr. Ali Alawi, Iraq's former Minister of Trade, Defense and Finance, discussing the Iraqi troubles in the context of a broader Middle East. That's it for this edition of Sophie & Co. I will see you next time.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.